guest is someone who's lived life on the edge, literally. We're joined by Brian Height, a professional stuntman turned performance psychologist and the founder of Brian Height Global. With a background that bridges high-risk action and high-level mindset training, Brian has worked with elite performers across industries, helping them push through pressure, reframe stress, and reach peak performance. He's the creator of Pressure X, Phase X, and Stress X programs, and the author of Begin Again. Before all that, he was jumping off buildings, taking hits, and helping bring intense action scenes to life in Hollywood. In this conversation, we're talking about what it takes to face fear head-on, how to build mental resilience in high-stakes environments, and why the mindset of a stuntman just might be the secret weapon for leaders, athletes, and anyone chasing their edge. This episode is all about performance under pressure. Brian Height, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. And I love the fact that you said high stakes instead of high pressure, high stress, because, yeah, as we'll get into, I don't think that's an accurate assessment of what those situations are actually like.
And that's something I want to talk a lot about, because I think there's a lot in there for people to learn from. Why don't you tell us, though, how you've had such a diverse professional career and how working as a stuntman and working as a psychologist, how'd you get to those places?
Oh, in a very circuitous, weird way that I wouldn't recommend for anybody. But it all started about halfway through college. I was trying to figure out, all right, well, what am I going to do? I'm at college where society has told me that I belong. And now I don't know what to do. And then I ended up watching a stunt show at a Six Flags in New Jersey and was captivated. I was mesmerized. And for the next 20 minutes after the first explosion happened and the motorcycles came jumping out, I was enthralled. And I ended the show because I knew the guy who was the company manager of that show. And I was able to go backstage and talk to the performers and really ask them, you know, how do you get this job? And after that conversation, that was it. I was hooked. I knew then what I wanted to do, which was a tremendous feeling. It really was hard being in college, going to the classes and really struggling with what's next. What am I supposed to be? And once I found that out, it was way easier, except that show happened during the summer and then school started again for my senior year and I couldn't pay attention to anything. I wanted no part of school. I hated school from kindergarten right on up. And once I figured out that what I wanted to do for the next however many years of my life had zero to do with a college degree, my motivation to get that degree completely plummeted. So I somehow or another made it through the first semester of my senior year without failing everything, but the second semester started bad and I was for sure failing. So I just dropped all the classes, dropped out and stuck around to do the show again at Six Flags for another summer and then moved to LA. And so I moved to LA to be a stuntman after having dropped out of college, and that's what I did. And then, you know, and then I was a stuntman for the next 4 or 5 years out in Los Angeles. They had the same show at the Six Flags out there, which was a huge boost for me because I was able to jump in, you know, to start work right away. And that it got me a chance to introduce to a bunch of the TV and film people as well. So that was how I got into the TV and film stunt aspect of things. And for the next 4 or 5 years, that was great until I realized I missed learning. That was a surprise when that realization came, but it was true nonetheless. And so I decided to go back to school, finish the degree that I had started. And once I'd done that, that timing coincided with me coaching gymnastics. And while coaching gymnastics, in stunts, I realized the importance of the mental piece, but it wasn't explicit. It wasn't in my face. I never really put two and two together, which seems ridiculous looking back on it, but I didn't really appreciate the mental part of stunts until I started the master's program in sports psychology. And I started learning about these different concepts and they became very top of mind. I had names for some of these things that I was experiencing and names for some of the techniques that I was even using without knowing I was using them to deal with these circumstances. So that was a really valuable thing for me on a lot of fronts. One, I was learning a lot of stuff and it was really interesting to me and I really enjoyed that. But I was immediately able to apply that stuff in my life, in training, between jobs, during jobs, all of it. And that was really great too, because one of the things that I hated so much about school was, I'm like, why am I learning? What is the point of this? How is this going to help me? Well, right away, I was able to see how this stuff helped me. So that continued. And then I finished that degree and was having so much fun that I continued on with the PhD in organizational psychology, but never with the intention of working in that field. So the fact that we're here talking about sport performance psychology applied to all the people that I work with is, again, that's not something that was ever part of the plan. I was going to just do stunts forever and just retire a stuntman, stunt coordinator. And that was going to be the end. But I really enjoyed the material and life does what it does. I ended up getting married and then that came with a stepdaughter, and the volatility and uncertainty of stunts was tough with a family. So I started looking for a real job that put me working with the Army as a sport performance psychology consultant. So there I am with the Army, never having been in the military, never even having had a job. I'm almost 30 years old and I got to figure out how to provide sport performance psychology services to an organization that had never had such a thing. So that was kind of a cool experience as well. Did that for a couple of years. Life changed again. Went back to LA after a divorce. Started doing stunts again. Did that for another 4 or 5 years. Met another woman. Got married. That came with another stepdaughter. And went the same thing. Went back to the Army job. But this time it was in Nashville, where I'm originally from, or outside of Nashville at Fort Campbell. And it was a little bit different. There was, in addition to the sport and performance psychology stuff, just the traditional performance of get your mind right so that you can perform well in the moment, there was also a resilience component. And I really gravitated toward that after just bouncing around through life and the divorce and all of the things. And then during that job, I got another divorce. So now there are two. So the resilience aspect of that program really pulled me in. And I spent a lot of time teaching that stuff around the globe to soldiers everywhere. And really the main difference was just, it wasn't the concepts. It wasn't even the theoretical grounding of what I was teaching. It was more the intent, because the intent was about what can I learn that can be useful no matter where I am or where the challenges are that I face, as opposed to traditional sports psychology, which is, all right, so I'm in this performance setting. Let's say it's shooting. If I'm working with the Army, you know, how do I make sure I shoot as well as I can in this performance situation? The resilience piece was more, how do I have what it takes? How do I develop the resources that allow me to, no matter the challenge, no matter the circumstance, no matter the people around me, to handle it well? So I really liked that. I really got into the literature, got into learning and teaching that, and, you know, did that for longer than I needed to. But that job came to a close for me. I left it and opened my own business, began again performance psychology, which then transitioned into what it is now, Brian Height Global. And the intent there was initially to work with athletes and performing artists in traditional sports psychology ways. But it morphed from that into, you know, after I had the realization that I did, into bigger things, into workshops, into keynotes, into things that I do with larger groups of people. I still work every now and then with one-on-one, you know, individual coaching and things, but I'm very selective about who I work with. I much more enjoy the writing the books, the creating the curricula, giving the talks, guiding the strategic approaches with these various organizations that I work with. And so that's where I am. Really, the latest thing about a year ago that guided all of this was the realization that where I think I belong is in this realm of high stakes performance, high stakes environments, high stakes jobs, high stakes situations, meaning any job, circumstance, situation where the consequences really matter. They're really important. You really care. The people really care that they do well. And if they don't do well, again, the consequences, there's a big difference between doing it right and doing it wrong. That's where I like to live. That's where I've spent the last 3 decades as a stuntman. That's where I saw a lot of the soldiers that I was working with, the work I really enjoyed doing with the special operations, special forces types of units. And this realm has allowed me to bring in this whole, you know, my experience with stunts, my experience in academia, my experience with the athletics that I participated in and coached, and the experience with the Army, you know, the 10 plus years that I spent working with them, into this one high stakes performance umbrella where I feel like I can bring the best of all of that to the people I work with.
Now, you talk about this word resilience, which I think is something these days that we don't focus enough on, that in a lot of ways, it feels like it's a lost skill. Can you talk about how you work with people to develop resilience and be sure within themselves within those high stakes settings and to not kind of crumble and shy away in those moments?
Yeah, resilience is one of those words that has a lot, it has different meanings for different people. And even in the literature, if you read about it, that all the researchers don't even agree on a single definition for what it is. So, for example, one way that resilience has been researched is when a challenging circumstance happens, how low do you get knocked down? The more resilient we are, we just don't get knocked down quite as far. Less resilient, we get knocked way down. Another way that it's been talked about is once a bad thing happens and we do get knocked down, how quickly do we return to where we were? So that's another definition. And then there's a third way that personally I gravitated toward and really lean into. And that is, yeah, we can look at, you know, how little you get knocked down, how quickly you come back. But more than that, how much were you able to grow as a result of the challenge that you faced? Were you able to improve as a result of going through what you did? That it comes from the literature in post-traumatic growth. So when these challenges arise in life, are we able to leverage those challenges to actually benefit ourselves and those around us? That's where I think resilience really lives. So that's where I focus. Now, how that happens, resilience tends to be, I think the easiest way to conceptualize it is it's just a math equation. And it's a math equation in the sense that the more resources we have available to us and the better able we are to leverage those resources in the various circumstances, the more resilient we're going to be. And when I say resources, I mean physical resources, mental resources, emotional resources, social resources, spiritual resources, financial resources. There are all kinds of different resources. The more we can cultivate those resources and really become proficient at leveraging and implementing those resources in the various circumstances we find ourselves, the more resilient we're going to be.
No, at least I find with myself that my ability to be resilient in certain situations can oscillate, that certain times I can bounce back more quickly, other times it's a slower paced thing. Do you find either with yourself or the people that you work with that it's more of an oscillation, that sometimes it's easier to be resilient than others?
For sure, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different variables that can go into the ease with which we not only bounce back, but grow and thrive as a result of the challenges that we face. I mean, it truly, all circumstances are unique. So the fact that it takes varying amounts of time for us to recover and again, grow from those things, I would say that that's the norm, not the exception.
Let's talk about what you had mentioned in liking the use of the term high stakes. Tell our audience how you are making a distinction from the concept and the thought of high pressure, high stress versus high stakes. And what does that mean?
I think it's a critical difference in a lot of ways. One, let's just start here. Stress and pressure are different. A lot of times they're conflated. People talk about stress and pressure like they're the same thing. They're not, and we can parse that later. But in terms of why I say high stakes versus high pressure or high stress, the reason is this, and this isn't new information I'm going to put out either. This goes back thousands of years. I wish I could claim it. I can't. The earliest reference to this that I've heard of is Epictetus, a Stoic philosopher, Stoicism philosopher from 2000 years ago, who said, it's not events that disturb us. It's our judgment about those events that disturbs us. And Marcus Aurelius, another Stoic philosopher, Roman emperor, said the same thing. Shakespeare said the same thing. Nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. It's not the situation that is inherently objectively good or bad. It's our judgment about that situation that will make it good or bad. And it's the same thing with stress and pressure. When we experience situations, they're just situations. When we work at jobs, they're just jobs. And whether we experience stress or pressure in those moments, in those circumstances, is entirely up to how we are interpreting that situation, how we are understanding it, the meaning that we are assigning to what's going on. So if we look at the situation one way, we experience stress. If we look at it a different way, we don't. And that's why I talk about pressure and stress as illusions. not illusions in the sense that they're not there, like we're fooling ourselves that we're not really experiencing stress and pressure. That's not it, because we are. Stress and pressure are very real. They're palpable. They're tangible. They are very powerful when we experience them. But we only experience them when we see situations, when we understand them in certain ways. The way example that I like to use is one that pretty much everybody's seen, the illusion of the old lady, young lady. So if you look at the picture, there's a picture, and if you look at it, and you can see an old lady with a big nose and a shawl, and then if you look at it a little bit differently, you see a young lady with a necklace and some eyelashes and big hair. The picture doesn't change. This is the important part. The picture doesn't change. The data are there. The information coming in is static. It stays the same. But we can experience that data in two very different ways. And we can't experience both of those ways simultaneously. We can bounce between them, but we can't experience both at the same time. It's one or the other, because it depends on our perspective. It depends on how we perceive it. And life is the exact same way. You and I could be in the exact same situation. You experience stress. I don't experience stress. And we all know that. And everybody has been in those situations where they, for whatever reason, they've experienced the stress and pressure and others around them haven't, or vice versa. But even within ourselves, we can find ourselves in situations and all of a sudden, I don't know, some piece of information occurs to us or some way that we're thinking about it changes and bam, the stress and pressure hit us hard. An example in my life has always been auditions. This is one of the ways that the sport and performance psychology stuff has been very helpful, because before I had that information, I felt incredible pressure when I would go into auditions, because what was in my mind wasn't getting the job. It wasn't acting. It wasn't performing. It wasn't doing the things I needed to do in order to be successful. It was on, I need to get this job because I got bills on the table that need to get paid. And if I don't get the job, then I'm not going to get the money and I can't pay the bills. And then I don't know. That's where my head was, a huge amount of pressure. Whereas had I gone in, now I know, had I gone in and just paid attention to, all right, well, what are the things I need to do to create conditions for success? Well, now my attention's in the right spot. I don't experience pressure and I can have a good time in that exact same situation. Not saying the consequences are different, still want the money, still have the bills, but in that environment, at that moment, if I'm present focused, and I'm paying attention to task relevant things and that's it, I don't experience the pressure. So that's why I say high stakes, because the consequences in a situation are there. And if we care about them, if they matter to us, that is a high stakes thing. If there is a big difference between success and failure and it matters to us, that is high stakes. That's something we can talk about. But there is no situation that by definition, always for everybody, will be stressful. Or pressureful. I'm talking about, you know, high pressure. So that's why I say when we call situations high stress situations or talk about high pressure jobs, I think it's a misnomer. I think that's inaccurate. And I think that's important because if we go into a situation assuming that because we are in that situation, we will experience stress and pressure, well, then we are going to experience stress and pressure. And that's not helpful. It's not beneficial. So that's why I think that distinction is so critical.
In what point in your career were you able to kind of make that reframe your mind to think that way, as opposed to feeling that high pressure, high stress that you were mentioning earlier in your career?
Yeah, there's not a moment that it's weird, because I've been, what Epictetus was talking about, what Shakespeare was talking about, the way I described all of that that's cognitive theory in psychology. Albert Ellis, Aaron Beck, they talk about the same exact thing. In fact, there's an ABC model a lot of people are familiar with: activating event, behavior, consequence. So all of this has been out there. All of it I've known. All of it I've played around with and even taught. But there was a moment, maybe a year or so ago, when I went this direction in my business where I don't know why it was. I can't remember exactly who I was talking to or what the conversation was, but high pressure came up and immediately a red flag went up in my head. And I thought, I don't even think that's real high pressure situation. Let me kick that around for a little bit. And I did. And I don't think it is real. I think for all the reasons that I just explained, there is no such thing as a high pressure situation. Now, again, there may be situations that people tend to experience pressure in, but it's not guaranteed, and you certainly don't have to. So it's been kind of a weird journey with that. There was a time when clearly I didn't know anything and I would experience stress and pressure willy-nilly like most people do. And then there was a middle period where I knew about it. I learned about it. I applied some of these things, but I didn't really put two and two together. And then it was about a year ago that I thought, all right, well, we're talking about this stuff all wrong. We should not be talking about high stress situations and high pressure situations. We can certainly, and we should be talking about high stakes situations when you really, truly want to be at your best because the consequences matter. But we can't talk about it in terms of high stress or high pressure. That's just, it's putting our focus on the wrong thing and really directing us in the wrong way to allow us to be at our best, to maximize the likelihood of us achieving the outcome that we really want to achieve.
We've talked with athletes and musicians, I would say kind of around this idea. And what seems to come to front of mind there is that preparation leads to things not feeling like they're moving too fast. So you hear about athletes as they kind of climb the ladder, high school to college to minor leagues to pros, that the game moves faster at every level. Or you're a musician, you're playing larger and larger venues and feeling like things are kind of speeding up on you. Preparation has seemed like a way to neutralize the potential negative effects of that growth. Would you say what you're thinking of in terms of mindsets around high stakes are further tools to be successful in those environments where you're kind of working in parallel with preparation? And if so, what are some of those ideas that seem fairly constant, that we're always falling back to this thought or that thought in a high stakes environment?
That's interesting. Yeah, I would say that the way that I conceptualize this and talk about it is a way of explaining why those people are experiencing what they're experiencing in the way that they are. And this is probably a really good time to distinguish between stress and pressure. And I'll get to why in just a second, but just to clear that up. So pressure, like we've been talking about before, that has to do with a problem of attention, where our attention is focused. And what I mean by that is, as I described earlier, if my attention is on the potential outcome, the potential consequences, not even outcome in terms of success or failure, but what success or failure means. If I fail, then whatever follows the then, that's the part that will create pressure. If, and this happens with success too, and this is something a lot of people, they don't, when they talk about high pressure situations, pressure can come when from success as well. So for example, if, you know, I walk into an audition and if my mind is on, man, if I get this thing, I'm going to be the next star. I'm going to be the next, you know, Brad Pitt, and my career is going to take off and I'm going to be set for the next 30 years. That kind of thinking also creates pressure. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a focus on failure that can generate pressure. It can also be a focus on the consequences of success, but it's all about the consequences. And the thing to remember about consequences is that they're not real. They're in the future. They're imaginary. We're just creating them in our minds. Now, there may be a high probability that the conclusions that we've drawn are correct. If I fail, then this bad thing will happen. There could be a high probability that we're right. But it hasn't happened. It's all still imaginary. And regardless of how right we might be, our attention's in the wrong place. Because our attention has to be, in order to maximize the likelihood of success, our attention has to be on what matters, which is what's in the moment, what's happening right now. What are the things I can control that I can do in this moment to create conditions for success? And that's how I like to think about it. That's the Eastern side of my whole deal, is the you know, things manifest when conditions are right. I noticed that on neither of your walls behind you is any grass. No grass is growing on the wall. Why? Because conditions aren't right for grass to grow. But I bet if you were to walk outside, you'd see some grass somewhere. Why? Because conditions are right for grass to grow. Well, if we're in high stakes situations, there are right conditions for us to be able to be at our best. So the job is identifying what those conditions are and then to create them. Well, one of those conditions is attention on the things that matter. So if we're experiencing pressure, our attention is not on the things that matter. It's on things that are imaginary in the future. So that's where pressure comes from. It can also come from the sense of have to, which is how pressure ties into motivation. If I feel like I have to do something, that creates pressure. But it's still tied to the consequences. Because if you were to tell me, you know, I have to do this thing, I would ask you, well, why do you have to do it? Well, because if I don't, then bam, there are the consequences. And that's where the pressure comes from. Stress, on the other hand, is about the situation and our perception of the situation itself and our relationship to that situation. This comes from, if there are any theory geeks out there, this is the transactional model of stress by Lazarus and Folkman. It's been around for 30 years or so, 40 years maybe at this point. And what it says is that when we're in a situation, we do what's called a primary appraisal. Is this situation a threat? Do I think that something bad might happen to me? If the answer is yes, then we move on to what's called a secondary appraisal. And that is, do I have the resources necessary to deal with this threat successfully? And if the answer is no, now we experience stress. So if we find ourselves in a high-stakes situation and we say to ourselves, is this a threat? And we say, yeah, this is a threat. And we say, you know, okay, well, can I handle it? Do I have the resources? And we say no. Well, now that's when we experience stress. But if we go into a situation we don't think it's a threat, it's like, you know, nothing bad will happen to us, or we do acknowledge the threat, and this is important, I'd like to come back to it in a second. We do acknowledge the threat, but we say, but yeah, I do have the resources necessary to handle it. Now we don't experience stress. And that can happen in the exact same situation. So whereas stress is, again, it's about the situation itself. It's our perception of the situation. Is it potentially harmful? Do we believe that it's potentially harmful to us in some way? Not necessarily physically. It could be mentally harmful, emotionally harmful. For example, maybe there's a challenging conversation that I really need to have with a coworker or a spouse or a child. And I don't know how that conversation is going to go. And I know that I tend to get pretty volatile when I talk about this situation. So there could be emotional consequences of being in this situation. It could be emotionally harmful for me or for the other person, which is then, you know, again, is it a threat to me? I don't like hurting people. So yeah, it is. Or it could be socially harmful, a social threat, meaning I don't want to lose this relationship with this person or these people or this group is really valuable to me. I don't want to lose it. But if I open my mouth and I say stuff that I think needs to be said, I might lose those relationships. So the threat doesn't necessarily need to be physical. It can be anything. But if we perceive a threat, then we move on to the resources. And if we don't believe that we have what it takes, I've already defined the resources earlier. I mean, there are a lot of them, but really what it comes down to is, do you have what it takes to deal with this situation effectively? The answer is no, that's stress. Pressure is about consequences. So that's the distinction between stress and pressure. And I think that that's a really important thing to for people to understand before we move forward.
Yeah, it's interesting as you're talking about that, I'm thinking of, we have a lot of patients that have tinnitus ringing in the ears that they find really bothersome. And we know one of the factors that can exacerbate that is stress. And we'll talk to our patients about stress and stress management. And we'll ask them, hey, have you had any changes recently in your stress level? And they'll respond in some way around, who doesn't? Who's not dealing with stress? Everybody has stress. Not recognizing that the way they're responding to what's going on in their life is having this manifestation for them that, and the manifestation is the tinnitus. So the tinnitus is the symptom of something else that's going on in their life. And we talk about ways to manage that, but that kind of gets outside of our area into your area. And I'm interested in how you talk to people about stress management and recognizing having the tools to handle situations versus developing the tools to handle situations.
Yeah, well, I don't know that there's a difference. You know, I mean, if anybody who's learned a skill knows, the skill goes away if you don't practice it. So even if I might have the resources and the things necessary today, tomorrow I might not if I don't continue to practice those things. So, but it's a great point that you make in that sometimes both stress and pressure are conflated with arousal, meaning that arousal is just your level of pumped upness, your amped upness, your energy activation level. That's what it is. And what happens is that we find ourselves in these high stakes situations. And because it matters to us, we're in a situation that's important, the sympathetic nervous system kicks in and various physiological changes will happen. Heart rate increases, muscles tense, pupils dilate, et cetera, and so forth. And people will interpret that often as, okay, well, I'm stressed. I'm feeling pressure. This is, they have to explain it somehow. They have to explain this change in physiology. And so that's one of the things that I really talk about. All of this stuff is interconnected. You can't change the mind without changing the body. For example, you know, if you talk about people, yeah, I'm under stress, for sure I am. Well, how do you know you're under stress? Well, I'm tense all the time. I can't focus on stuff. All right, well, so those are the symptoms of stress. You got that. So how are you understanding this situation? Well, because if it's, I don't think I can deal with it. I'm questioning my ability to handle this well. Okay, but what if you were able to handle it? Like, let's talk about what some of the resources you actually do have. And this is where I get into it with people is, number one, what do you have that maybe you don't even know that you have, or at least you have it and it doesn't come immediately to mind when you think about yourself in terms of resources, or you know you have it, but maybe not quite as strongly as you could. So for example, you know, a physical resource truly can be sleep. You know, do you sleep well? No, I don't sleep well at all. All right, well, let's start there. Let's start figuring that out. Or yes, I do sleep well. You know, how can I leverage that? Well, you know what? If you have some challenging situations coming up and you know that there are some high stakes moments occurring, maybe plan your sleep ahead of time so that you know for sure several nights you're getting some good sleep and you take the steps to do that. That would be an example of a physical resource that the person has or doesn't, can change or not, but can create conditions to have happen to benefit them in these situations. Because that physical change, just sleep, affects how we perceive situations. Every single one of us knows if we're tired or we're hungry. My daughter loves this. She can tell me, like, Dad, you need to go eat something. She can tell, because if I'm hungry, my emotions are volatile. I don't regulate nearly as well. My patience, which is already very low, it becomes almost none. And all of that's mental, but it's the result of something physical. So we have to really start to tune into what are these resources that we have, number one, and to what extent are we capable of bringing those resources into these moments? And I want, this kind of bleeds over into your other question that I didn't end up answering about the preparation piece with the different performers, is that, because I said the differentiation between stress and pressure can help explain why that preparation tends to slow things down or lower the stress in these situations. And the reason for that is because the preparation is an increase in resources. So if we tend to go into the high stakes situation stressed out, it's because we don't think we have what it takes. Well, the more preparation that we have, obviously the more resources we're developing, the more likely we will be to answer the question when it comes up, can we handle this? We answer that question with a yes. Now that has nothing to do with pressure, which is why I think it's useful to distinguish the two, because you could have somebody who is 100% fully prepared, who truly does believe in their ability to do this thing well, and still have that person experience pressure if their attention is misdirected, if their attention is focused more on the consequences of success or failure rather than what's happening in the moment.
What you said earlier reminds me of something I've heard Simon Sinek talk about. You're talking about the physiological changes the body experiences during stress. Those are the same physiological changes the body is experiencing during excitement. Yep. And how are we interpreting that message? So are you able to look at that environment where you're up with the bases loaded, two outs, and the winning run on second base as, wow, this is exciting, and you're interpreting your body in that way? Or are you interpreting your body in an overwhelmed, stressed sort of way that makes it much more difficult to perform? And I think once people become aware of what their body is doing and what is it potentially telling them, they can interpret it in healthier, more productive ways, which goes towards some of the mindset you've discussed.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that. I'm working right now on a theory, a model that kind of puts all of this stuff together. And where it's landing right now in terms of excitement is if we go into a situation, and well, let me, because I said I was going to get to this earlier, and I think it's important. What we hear a lot in terms of situations where we experience stress is, don't look at it as a threat. Don't look at it as something bad. Like, look at it as an opportunity. Look at it as a challenge. That's all great. And I think that can happen. But I'll tell you from personal experience that when I'm looking at a car that's driving at me and I'm about to get hit by it, there's no mental gymnastics that I can do that can...
You're not excited?
It's a threat. I am excited. That's my point. That's where I'm going. It's a threat. I can't label it any other thing. Yes, something bad might happen to me. I have to acknowledge that. I can't rainbow and unicorn it. There's no way to do that. And the same thing for first responders. If you're going into a burning building or you're getting ready to clear a room or military people, like if you're in a situation where truly, I mean, the consequences matter. You cannot switch things around. No, it's not a threat. We can't do that. But if we can get to that secondary appraisal and answer with a yes, yes, 100%, I have the resources to deal with this. Bring it. That's where the fun is. That's where the excitement lies. For me, that's what it is. That's the whole reason that I pursue challenging situations, physical and otherwise. I enjoy testing those resources. I enjoy implementing those resources. And sometimes there's a little bit of doubt around whether my resources are going to be sufficient or not. And that's where some of that nervousness that can creep in happens too. It's not full excitement. It's not full leaning in. There's still a little bit of doubt, a little bit of nervousness is there, because I'm not 100% certain that those resources are going to be sufficient. But the more I am certain that those resources are sufficient in those situations that truly are a threat to me, because I believe that it is, that's where excitement lives. So the nervousness, fear, the way I see that is like they're just more specific forms of stress. So when we talk about stress, we're talking about nervousness falls into that category, fear falls into that category. It's just it's an intensity level of stress that we're experiencing. Panic is stress. All those things fall in there because I perceive a threat and I don't think I can handle it. That's where nervousness, fear, and panic come in. But flip it and say, yeah, it's a threat. Something bad might happen, but I absolutely have what it takes and I can't wait to show it. Now I got a whole different thing. And you're right. Physiologically, it is. There are a couple people out there now arguing that some of the, I don't know, blood vessels or something don't dilate as much with negative or positive. I don't know what it is. But for all intents and purposes, and certainly from an experiential standpoint, we can't tell the difference physiologically whether we're experiencing fear or excitement. Either way, it is identical. And that actually gets into confidence too. Albert Bandura is another guy who he came up with self-efficacy theory, which self-efficacy is essentially confidence. It's the extent to which you believe you're capable of being successful in any situation. And one of the sources, therefore, of confidence is how we interpret those physiological changes when they come. Because we can interpret them as, well, they're indicative of me not being ready. So yeah, nervousness, fear. Or I can interpret them as, well, it's my body doing what it does. My body does this. It does this to prepare me. So thank God it is. I'm now ready and I can be at my best. Two very different interpretations of the exact same thing. And they lead to different responses, emotionally and behavioral.
Can you recall a time, since you've worked with so many different types of people, can you recall a time where you've noted progress and how somebody has framed their mind with these high stakes in terms of their high pressure, high stress, how you've seen them progress?
Oh, yeah. There are, this is such a huge issue with people that it happens all the time. But I mean, just the most recent one was a teenage kid that I was working with. He was a swimmer. He was, you know, swimming in college, and his biggest challenge was the pre-competition anxiety. He would just get so anxious, so stressed out around the thing. And it's a combination of stress and pressure. I'm not saying that because stress and pressure are different, but they can also feed each other and happen at the same time. He had both. I mean, he would go back and forth between doubting his ability to be successful in the situation, the resources that he had, and focusing on the consequences of that failure that he thought was very likely because he didn't have the resources. So there were both things going on. And really, I mean, we started with just, look, here's this situation. There is the present moment. There's not the past. That's done. There's not the future because that's not real. There is right now. So right now is what you have. What can you do right now in this moment that can help create conditions, whether it's the day before or the minute before you jump in the pool? What are the things that you can do to help create conditions for you to achieve what you set out to achieve? And once you start flipping your mindset to really being able to be present and really recognize this moment as the moment where change occurs, because here's the thing, the future is going to be, it always is, created by what happens in the present, always. So if you want something in the future, well, right now is the time to do whatever's necessary to make that happen. So let's get after that. Let's start identifying what some of those things are. And there's a program that I have called Phase X. It's the four-phased approach to performance. We developed it when I was with the military. I've since branched it out into other areas. But really what that comes down to is before, right before, during, and after, those are the four phases of performance. And in each of those phases, we need to focus on physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, what do we need to do to create conditions that would allow us to thrive? How do we do that? And that was what I did with him. So we broke the performance down into those four phases. We identified physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, things he could do in each of those four phases in each present moment that created conditions for his unique circumstances to allow him to flourish. And that was really beneficial for him.
My last question for you would be, an idea that we've enjoyed exploring on this podcast is becoming a part of people's stories, that we get to do that with our patients with hearing loss and giving them access to sound again. Is there a time you can look back and think on, wow, I really got to become a part of that individual's story and have an impact?
That's a great question. I just had this conversation earlier, but in not the way that's going to be where your mind was. But I think it's really important. I was a foster parent for 4 years and I worked. I don't anymore because I'm engaged and that's coming with two extra kids and we've got a house full. So I don't foster anymore, but I did for 4 years. And before that, I was working with kids in various things with coaching. The YMCA was one of the places that I worked with them when I was in high school and college. And I gravitated toward the kids who tended to just have more challenging lives than others. And I was an unofficial big brother to this one kid. And every now and then I'd stop by his house. I'd pick him up. We'd go to a theme park. We'd go shoot pool. We'd go watch a movie, whatever. I would take him to go do some stuff. Well, then I went off to college, kind of lost touch with his parents. And it was 15 years later. And I was living in Los Angeles, not Nashville, which is where he and I were doing all this stuff. And I got a call from him. I have no idea how he got my number. And he said, hey, this is me. And I don't know if you remember, but you and I, you know, we used to hang out when I was a kid. And I said, yeah, I said, I'm in LA. Do you want to link up? And I met this kid and he told me, I'll never forget it, man. He was telling me, he said, you have no idea what was going on in my house. I wouldn't be alive if it weren't for you. I truly believe that. And I said, what are you talking about? Like, we were just going to have fun. He said, no. My mom, she was divorced. She had a boyfriend. The boyfriend was beating the mom. The boyfriend was beating and abusing the kid. The kid ended up, it was all kinds of stories that he came out telling me. He said, the only thing that allowed me to hang on, that allowed me to keep moving forward, and it even helped my mom too, was you. So I just wanted to say thank you. Had no idea that I had that impact on the kid. And I think, and through the fostering, I had, I don't know, dozens of kids come through the house. None of them ever said thanks. My hope is that all of them remember at least a little something, you know? I mean, I don't need the thanks. That's not the point. The point is that we just don't know sometimes the influence that we have on other people's lives. In my experience, it's very rare that we actually know the extent to which we've affected people. So to answer your question, yeah, that was one example, was that kid. I hope that there are others with other kids who I've worked with and other clients that I've worked with. And so, you know, but I think that if we are aware of those influences that we've had on others, it is only a small percentage of the influence that we've actually had on countless other people we don't even know.
Man, thank you for sharing your story about that. I'm so bummed that we only have 45 minutes. I could listen to you talk all day. I'm enthralled. But I know you have somewhere to be. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sharing your talk about your extremely unique professional work. We're excited to see what comes next for you. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you if they want to find out more about you, your work, your book? Can you tell people where they can connect with you?
Yeah, I would go to brianheiteglobal.com, BRIANHITE global.com. That's the website. You can email me directly, and please do, at brian@brianheiteglobal.com. I love hearing from people who have listened to the podcast and have questions. I'm happy to answer all of them. You can schedule discovery calls and whatnot if any of the things that I've talked about seem relevant to your situation, or if you're part of an organization and you think the organization would benefit from hearing some of this stuff too, I I mentioned at the beginning, I do keynotes, I do workshops on stress, pressure, motivation, burnout, and the phases of performance, please reach out. I really, when you're going through hard times with these different areas, they are hard times, but there's a way out. And there's a way to, again, create those conditions where we can thrive and flourish, even in the most high stakes environments. So please reach out. I'd love to talk to you.
Brian, thanks so much. We're going to link to all of that in the episode bio, and we appreciate your time, your insight, and as Michelle said, your unique perspective. I like the way you're helping the audience think about how they're interacting with the world, and I appreciate you sharing everything with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed talking about the material, and I appreciate you allowing me the opportunity.
Our pleasure. All right, Dr. Brian Hite, thank you so much.
All right. Take care.